Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Indeed, today is the day. It is Wednesday. Almost said February. It's not February. It is May. It's May the 22nd, 2019. Where in the Word are you today? I hope you don't grow weary of my asking that question because I intend to keep asking it. Where in the Word are you today? Our family revisited Genesis 1:1 last night as a part of cracking open the If What If devotional book that we talked about here on the show when we had co-authors, father and son team, Tony and Daniel Miles on. And so we thought that as a family, you know what, let's jump in. Let's see what's in here. It was a really provocative conversation, and it gave us an opportunity to not only talk about God as the creator, but ask if and what if questions of one another that were, you know, frankly, pretty provocative. So there you go. If you missed that conversation, you can grab the podcast at myfaithradio.com under the Mornings with Carmen tab or under the podcast section. So where in the Word are you today? I am in the book of Genesis. We also read the end of Genesis because we have been, as a family, talking about Joseph, and that is where his, the portion of his story in terms of his life here on earth comes to an end. His legacy certainly redounds to this day. Okay, so the other thing we talked about that I would like your help on is finding a word to serve as an antonym for gossip. So we have the word gossip, and we know we're not supposed to do it. That falls into the thou shalt not bear false witness or just negative witness. You're not supposed to be a pepper picker. And so let's not be gossips and let's not gossip. Okay, but what's the opposite of that? What do you call a person who tattletales on people for doing good, who catches people doing good? And what do you call them giving that kind of positive testimony? Like, what do we call that in our culture? Does that have a word? Well, according to my Google search, it doesn't have a word, which is like stunning because, you know, the Googler seems to know everything. So some of you contributed words into the, you've thrown some words into the conversational pot, into the mix. This is going to be a topic of conversation here tomorrow, which we are going to dedicate much of our conversation tomorrow to kindness. Tomorrow is going to be Kindness Day in the spirit of Mr. Rogers of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. So tomorrow is going to be Kindness Day in the whole state of Pennsylvania. So I'm just joining them in that. And so we're going to talk about maybe coming up with a word as an antonym for gossip. So I need your input. You can give me your input by texting me at 877-933-2484. You can also email me your suggestions, carmen@myfaithradio.com. So far, three words have been offered up, one by my husband, who likes Greek. And so he has given us a Greek word, which you can already tell by the tone of my voice. I am resisting. Part of that is I don't know how to pronounce it. So eulogia. Eulogia. That's just too hard to say. I can't call a person
eulogia. It's the same word we get eulogize from.
I know. And so I don't want that word as the word that we're going to have. Thank you, Paul. Like, right? Yes. Do people want to consider the eulogizing, right? It's for celebrating the good. Oh, maybe it is a good word for this.
Yeah.
Oh.
We usually think about it when when somebody has died, but to eulogize actually just means to speak well of somebody.
Oh, goodness. Maybe we already have a word. It's just not a word that I'm too excited about making, like, the word. All right. I'm writing it down. Eulogize. All right. Eulogia. Other contestants thrown into the mix. One of our listeners offered up the word good speak. Could we just call it good speak and could we call them good speakers? That's a possibility. Another person said, well, hey, if it's gossip, maybe the opposite could be good sip. We could start calling it good sip. And I don't know. That might sound a little like we're throwing back a little, I don't know. So, all right. I don't think we've landed on it yet. But Eulogia may actually rise to the top now that Paul has told me what it like. He's brought this into the mix. Okay. Today's program is going to be heavy on I words: impeachment, Iran, Israel, and immigration. There you go. We're going to cover some I words today in the headline news. We're going to lead off with a conversation with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. Iran has certainly been topping the headline news in terms of, nasty relations that we have with them. Here is a little good news on that front. This hot mess does look like it has at least momentarily de-escalated. The Trump administration said on Tuesday the threat of hostilities with Iran has receded. And they have assured lawmakers that war is not imminent. So that's really positive, but we're going to get more on that from Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. That's up next. Joining us again today is our friend Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. Drew, welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Carmen. How are you?
Good morning. I am well. Thank you. So we are all aware at various levels of this rising tension between the United States and Iran. We're all aware of skirmishes and all kinds of Twitter barbs that are going back and forth. There's real action on the ground. And so I'm just hoping that you can kind of brief us in on the situation between the U.S. and Iran.
Sure. I think that looking at the timeline is probably important. The rising tensions between the United States and Iran have really begun to rise as Donald Trump took office. Donald Trump, when he was running for president, promised to withdraw the United States from the Iran nuclear deal, which is technically called the JCPOA, and the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was a agreement signed between Germany, France, Great Britain, and the United States and Iran to limit the nuclear development that Iran had been undergoing in the 2000s. President Obama signed this. Donald Trump said he would withdraw from this. And about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, we withdrew from the JCPOA, and we began instituting a series of sanctions against Iran, sanctions to target different levels of their economy and to target different levels of their political regime. And the purpose of these sanctions is two or threefold, really. It's one, to punish Iran for being a state sponsor of terrorism. Iran sponsors organizations like Hezbollah and Hamas. Hezbollah that has woven its way into the Syrian conflict and is a major kind of political and terror presence in Lebanon and throughout the Middle East. They also sponsor terrorist cells within within Iraq, and are really just they're like crabgrass throughout the Middle East. There's just underneath the surface, and every occasionally pops up these terrorist groups that are sponsored by Iran. And this is one of the ways that Iran kind of exerts its control and its influence in the Middle East. We want to punish them for this, so we institute sanctions. We also want to limit their ability to develop nuclear weapons. The Trump administration did not believe that the JCPOA or this nuclear deal that the Obama administration signed was an effective way to do that. and so they are trying to apply outward pressure, saying, look, it is not in your interest, Iran, to develop nuclear weapons. If you do, it could be, you know, the consequences could be great. And so the Iranian economy has suffered from these sanctions. They're in a recession. Their currency is tanking. And so the pressure that we have applied has worked, and to the extent to which it has placed Iran in a difficult and, I think, kind of tense position. Iran, though, has responded now by kind of out of frustration, saying, look, you've cut off our oil revenue. You've cut off economic investment into our country. You've cut off diplomatic relations between us and much of the rest of the world. You know, we don't have much else to do at this point other than to maybe begin to flex our muscles maybe break away from the Iran nuclear deal and begin developing our own nuclear weapons, and begin kind of acting out militarily and beefing up our military presence in the Middle East. And so you see what we have done here in the United States and what the Trump administration has done just recently is send a carrier group into the Persian Gulf to show that Iran that we are ready and willing to act militarily if need be. And so the tensions really are rising. And I think we have to take this seriously. This isn't just rhetorical saber rattling, that there are sides here that have been at odds for really 40 years. And even though we've had periods where this is kind of reached a denouement and kind of quietened down, we're those tensions are increasing. So it's very much worth, I think, our watch and our concern.
So, Drew, for folks who, you know, they sort of know Iran in the back of their mind as the place where there were U.S. hostages, like we remember that we remember that period of our history. But I'm not sure that everybody recognizes that for Iran, politics is religion and religion is politics. And so we're not having a conversation with another democracy like our own. And we are having a conversation with a country that actually believes that there's a redeemer coming, and it's, you know, not Jesus, that there will be this redeemer of Islam, and there will be this world run under that individual's leadership. And so can you talk a little bit here about the intersection or the importance of understanding the Islamic nature of the Islamic Republic, which is Iran's form of government?
Sure. So the Islamic Republic is just that. It's a theocracy. It's not a democracy. It's not a monarchy. It's not some sort of parliamentary system. I mean, it's a theocracy that's run by a combination of religious clerics that are Islamic leaders and people who are elected. It's not the kind of they have a president, they have a legislature, but it's not the type of democracy that we understand. There's a Republican element that they elect representatives, but ultimately the state is controlled by the supreme leader, the Grand Ayatollah. And so it is an oppressive regime that seeks to, and part of the Iranian revolution was to see this idea of Iran, this idea of kind of a caliphate, if you will, of a Iranian system and theocratic system proliferate out through the Middle East. And Iran is a massive country. It's a huge, huge country. It's much larger than Iraq. It's much larger than Persia, which is what Iraq technically is, stretches all the way from the Caspian Sea to the Persian Gulf to India. It's a massive country. It's not Arab. It's technically Persian. It's an Indo-European language they speak as Farsi, not Arabic. And so it's a complex society, and it's very undemocratic. It has one of the worst human rights records of any country on the planet. They frequently will arrest, critics of the government and jail critics of the government. So in terms of worldview and ideology, this is not a worldview or an ideology that we want to see proliferate out through the Middle East. And it's certainly not one that we want to see spread into any other part of the world. It needs to be kept into check. And the ultimate goal, I think, of the United States currently under John Bolton, who's the National Security Advisor, is some type of regime change. And there are a number of ways to kind of go about that. But this is kind of the stated policy of the current National Security Advisor. And that is the United States government's only hope that maybe some level of reformation or reform can happen there in Iran so it can be a viable partner in the Middle East for economics and for freedom.
So as we go to the break, let me just note that that idea of a regime change or reformation for people who believe that they are in the positions that they are in by the design of their God, who are operating as a theocracy, that is not going to be easily yielded. And so I just think that we need to be keeping the people of Iran in our prayers, even as we continue to pay attention to what's happening on this geopolitical front. All right, Drew and I are going to pivot our conversation to Israel and the president's plan related to Israel when we come back from the break. Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine continues here with me on Mornings with Carmen. Continuing my conversation now with Drew Griffin from Providence Magazine. And Drew, let's pivot to Israel. Talk with us about I'll describe it as the president's plan related to Israel, and then I'm going to put some question marks after the word plan.
Right. Yeah. It's been a much talked about plan since he took office. After the president took office, President Trump, he put his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who's doesn't, I think, have an official title other than kind of advisor to the president, put him in charge of instigating some and coming up with some sort of plan for peace in the Middle East and peace specifically vis-a-vis Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And so over the last 2 years, Mr. Kushner has done this. And so we're up to the point now that there's some sort of release that is going to happen in a week or so with the peace plan. And it's going to happen in a couple of phases. The first phase is going to happen at the Bahrain conference there in Bahrain. And they're coming about it at a different way than they have typically. Typically, peace process discussions between Israel and the Palestinian Authority have gone through kind of a political track in which they have tried to address many of the political concerns and hangups that the two sides have with one another. The idea of borders, the idea of settlements, the idea of Jerusalem as Israel's capital and joint sovereignty over the Temple Mount, and all of these kind of political concerns that dominate the discussions. Mr. Kushner is taking a different track, apparently, and has come at it in this first phase from an economic standpoint and has gathered together a number of economic leaders, invited a number of economic leaders within the Palestinian Authority, businessmen, industry leaders. And even though the Palestinian Authority currently is kind of boycotting the Trump administration and not speaking to them, Mr. Kushner is talking to these economic leaders and inviting them to the table. And the idea is to try and build some sort of bridge, economic bridge, that can add an incentive for the Palestinians and for the Israelis to come to some kind of grips on the political questions that they face. It's an interesting tack. It's an interesting strategy. But the problem is that really, if you're going to address economics, if you're going to address, you know, the financial situation in the Palestinian Authority, or even in Israel, like, you have to address the political questions. Like, you can push it off and push the ball down the field all that you want. But at some point, in order for there to be economic stability and vitality in the Palestinian Authority or in Gaza, let's say, you have to have political stability and you have to have security. I mean, these things go hand in hand anywhere in the world. If you want greater economic viability, you have to have the rule of law. You have to get rid of corruption. You have to end corruption. You have to foster an element of safety and justice, so that businesses can operate and so that the environments are attractive to investment. And absent those kind of political and security changes, economic development is going to be very difficult. And so it's an interesting track, and President Trump has been very, you know, positive and effusive about his praise for Mr. Kushner and his abilities. And I certainly, you know, hope for peace and hope for kind of a rapprochement of the various military actions that have been occurring in Gaza recently. I think that one way or another, you have to deal with the difficult questions. You have to deal with the political questions. And that is really the only way that you're going to see some level of agreement, if peace is even possible at the end of that.
So I'm going to press the question because I see all of this as related. I think that when we hear the president make an existential threat against a nation like Iran that is a theocracy, And when we talk about Israel in relationship to its neighbors who don't even recognize that it has a right to exist, and that's a religious conflict. That conflict is between Islam and Judaism, or the Muslims and the Jews, maybe more accurately stated. There's a religion and religious storyline under all of the conversations. And so I felt the same way when we were talking about China at another point. Like, I feel like we're trying to have economic conversations and political conversations without recognizing that at the basic level, what we're having is a religious conversation without having it. And so I am a little frustrated by that, Drew. I'll just admit that the what seems to me so clear, which is that if I don't recognize the dignity of the other person, because I actually think because of my religious system that they're not even a person and don't deserve to be allowed to live or whatever, or I don't believe in a God at all, which is the situation when we're dealing with China, it's hard for me to imagine how we get to the place just by economics and politics.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, one of the whole reasons why we have Provenance, this journal, and the website, provenanceman.com, is the idea that we want to equip the American mind to engage the real world. And what we mean by real world is kind of like what really is going on, the underlying spiritual reality that informs all of the news stories that we read and informs the world leaders that we read about. And you're absolutely right. The idea that we can divorce these issues and divorce politics from religious considerations is really naive, because everyone is inherently religious. Every culture is inherently religious, is informed by that religion, whether it's Islam, whether it's Christianity, whether it's secularism, which is its own form of kind of religious adherence and dogma. Every one of these cultures is informed by that, and we have to understand that. And I know that, you know, ultimately, as Christians, we believe that there is a greater truth and a greater truth giver, who is God, who has revealed his truth to us in Scripture. And so we know that there's a plumb line that guides all religious conversations, and that, you know, plumb line is the Bible and the truth about humanity and the truth about God's character that's revealed in that Bible and in that revealed word. And so because of that, we know that there are some real truths that inform these situations, one of which is, yes, that every single person is created in the image of God, and they're have inherent worth and inherent dignity, and should be treated with a certain level of respect, regardless of where they're from and where they live and kind of what they believe, that there's something about them that's special that needs to be protected, and that we need to err on the side of life and freedom when possible. But the other part of that truth and revealed truth is the fact that there is sin in the world, that sin and that fallenness is just as pervasive, unfortunately, as the image of God, because it affects each and every one of us. And so there are bad actors out there. There are people who are going to act out badly, who are going to act out in sinful and evil ways. And it isn't always just enough to tell them to stop. I mean, at some point you have to send in the carrier group. At some time you have to send in the 101st Airborne in order to stop them from doing the evil that they are perpetrating. And that's an act of love. Stopping them is an act of love. It's a loving act to stop them from engaging in further sin. And it's a loving act to protect those that they're sinning against. And so these are the truths, I think, that inform what is really going on. And our hope in Providence and even shows like yours is that the kind of message can get out there to people who are in the seats of power, that when they're looking at these issues and when they're heading into the, you know, negotiating table, that they do so well informed, that there is a reality deeper than just economic issues and just quantitative issues, that there's a qualitative reality here that has to be acknowledged. And if we ignore it, we do so really at our peril.
Drew Griffin, Providence Magazine. See, I knew that I could probably get you to preach. So there you go. I'm feeling very satisfied.
Okay.
Feeling very satisfied with myself right now. Okay, you guys can check it all out at providencemag.com. Drew, we look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you, Carmen.
All right, friends, I'm going to take a quick break, and then I'll be right back. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen.
Okay, we have heard in the news that a fifth juvenile migrant has died in a U.S. Detention facility on the southern border. It's actually in McAllen. McAllen is now shut down for a flu outbreak. It's now quarantined. We are going to talk with a professor from Cedarville University who has been to the detention center at McAllen. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Joining me now, Dr. John Tarwater, Assistant Professor of Finance at Cedarville University. He has seen firsthand the crisis at the southern border. He is a former resident of McAllen, Texas, which is southeast of Laredo. And it is the conversation point today in terms of U.S. immigration migrants coming across the southern border, the conditions in which they are seeking to live. We're here today to hear about and talk about how Christians in those border communities are responding. So, Dr. Tarwater, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you so much, Carmen. Glad to be here.
So you and I could not have anticipated yesterday that this morning we would be talking about a quarantine of the facility in McAllen, Texas. We did not know that we were going to be talking about the death of a fifth juvenile migrant in U.S. custody in a detention facility since just December. Give us your perspective. Just, you've been there, you've seen it, you've experienced it. Draw us emotionally into what's happening at the southern border.
I've seen it really in two respects. My wife and I worked with a nonprofit organization called Camino Global, which in 2012, 2013 had us living in Guatemala. And so living in Guatemala, we got to see firsthand what the violence was like and what the poverty was like. There in Guatemala City, we have the largest landfill in all of Central America. There are about 12,000 people who actually live in the dump. In 2014, the mission moved us to McAllen, and it was in 2014 when we first began to see that first wave of people coming across the border. And at the time, it was around 250 per day. And we thought at the time that these were just massive numbers. Now, the ministry with which I was involved wasn't primarily ministering to immigrants and refugees. It was ministering, however, to Latinos. I was working at a ministry that had a radio station that reached down into Mexico. We had a retirement center of about 500 residents. And I was the vice president at a college for Latinos, where all the classes and everybody there was working with Latinos. And so when the immigration issue started, even though it wasn't our issue, if you will, it was our constituents. And so we felt compelled to get involved. And we began to see just really hundreds and thousands of workers from all over the U.S. come down and begin to assist with the situation. And even though it began to die down a little later, at the time, we could not have imagined the numbers that we're seeing today, with more than 1,000 really per day coming across the border there in McAllen. Really, 50% of all the illegal crossings or all the refugees coming in take place in the McAllen Center there in McAllen, Texas.
Okay, give us a little geography lesson here. We know where San Diego is, and we know where Corpus Christi is. But our geography between San Diego and Corpus Christi is just bad. So where is McAllen?
Yeah, good question. When you think of, if you picture Texas and that long pointed end that goes down into Mexico, the very border there is called, the very tip down there is called Brownsville. And if you go about 100 miles west, staying on the border, you're at McAllen.
Okay, so we're really talking about, an eastern part of the conversation in terms of the border. And I think that's helpful because when we think of, I mean, this is going to sound like I am lumping people into very big categories. But when I think of people on the extreme west coast of the United States, I don't necessarily think of the same kind of people that I think of who are deep in the heart of Texas in terms of ministries of compassion, and particularly in the area of hospitality. So tell us what your experience has been of the response of Christians in southern Texas specifically to those who are seeking shelter and asylum in the United States
particularly in McAllen?
Good question. At the time when it first began to happen in 2014, one of the largest groups that reacted was the Southern Baptist Convention. They began to send down mobile shower units, laundry facilities, bathrooms. And these were really like large trailers, brand new, and so it made tremendous help. A lot of the churches that live there in what we call the valley, the Rio Grande Valley, began to get involved. The church where I was a part of, at Calvary Baptist Church, a number of the people began to work as washing laundry and stuff like that for the people who had been detained. Buckner Ministries donated thousands of shoes for the children. Volunteers really came from all over the nation, beginning to work in food banks and to work in what we called the respite center there in the food bank. People were making baggies of items to send for the children who were there, crayons, coloring books, just little storybooks. They had toothpaste, toothbrushes, just any ways that they could help alleviate some of the issues. Now, personally, my wife and I, again, we're English and Spanish speaking people living in a Latino community. And so for several years, we worked only in Latino churches. But the last 3 years or so in the Valley, we were at a church that was roughly 50% English speaking, 50% Spanish speaking. And so some of the members who were at the church were also ICE units, Border Patrol agents. And as a result, we became close to that community. And this is part of the community that often gets lost in the story. By the time many of the many of the volunteers began to leave because the numbers went down, the result is that we still have items being sent to food banks. We have shoes being sent, clothes being sent, but nobody to work them. Mm. And now that the influx has returned more than fourfold, we don't have all the volunteers there. And so the result is the ICE agents and Border Patrol agents, they're just overwhelmed. And I'm not saying that their issue is worse than that of the refugees, but it is a tangible way that my wife and those people around us could actually attempt to be compassionate. We would have them over to our house. We would make goodies for them and try to express love to those. That's correct.
Yeah, serving the servants. Okay, you and I need to take a quick break, Dr. Tarwater. But when we come back, I'd like to invite our listeners to consider how they might respond wherever they are across the Upper Midwest or the heartland of the United States, from the East Coast to the West. How would you have Christians across the country tangibly responding to the crisis at the southern border? So that conversation up next with Dr. Tarwater from Cedarville University. So one of our listeners, Dr. Tarwater, has posted, "My heart breaks hearing about all of the crisis on the border." She's talking about what the feelings are that are rising up within her, some of which I won't read here on the air. And she wishes that those in Washington were more worried about this issue than some of the other things that seem to be consuming their time. Talk with us about the calling upon Christians here in the United States of America, and how we can respond. You talk about moral obligation, not only to obey the laws of our own land, but the moral obligation to care for those who are in need and who desperately need to be shown mercy and compassion. Draw us into that, to that spirit in that conversation.
Thank you, Carmen. As Christians, we do not always have to agree, I believe, on the details of public policy. In fact, I think it'd be impossible for us to do so. But I do believe that as Christians, we should recognize that our first response should be one of compassion and mercy for those who are detained. And I believe that we're witnessing a group of individuals who are seeking to overthrow our governments, but rather they're seeking freedom and opportunity, which are concepts that historically have been part of our American story. And so I would encourage people listening to look for ways to be compassionate and merciful to all the parties that are involved. Pray that our government leaders will come to some resolution to help alleviate the people. Three things come to mind. One is we do all that we can to vote for the right representatives, whoever that is. I'm not, pushing any point of view, but it does call for us to take action on a political end in that way. Another way we do this or get involved is by becoming well-informed citizens who enter into the public discussion, debate with our fellow citizens and our representatives. And then I think a final way we do this is by extending the hand of friendship to immigrants and refugees that we encounter in our neighborhoods, in our cities. It starts small. It looks for people around us. We love those in our community, but then we seek to love those who are far off, whom we're calling the refugees in this situation, or the immigrants.
So I think that, there are those, you have experienced them, I've experienced them, people who immediately push back. And I think they push back because they don't recognize just how similar the situation is in Central America to the situation that European immigrants were facing when frankly, my forebears left England and left Germany to come to the United States of America. They were fleeing terrible situations, and they were under religious fear. The fears may be different in Central America than they were in Europe, but the fear is the same. Like, right, the human desire to be in a better place for my kids, to get to be sure that the next generation has a better opportunity for a flourishing life than what I'm experiencing wherever I live. Like, that is what has moved people massively over the course of time around the globe. Can you talk a little bit about how this is really not that different than mass migrations we've seen in the past? It's just our first experience of it.
That's right. It's hard for a lot of our listeners, or even a lot of the people who watch the news on a regular basis. A lot of the issues get lumped together, and we see them as one, when in fact the refugee and immigration debate are two different debates. Refugees, by nature of the case, generally do not enter the country illegally. To be officially recognized as a refugee, they must go through official channels. Where immigrants, they may enter either legally or illegally. But here's the kicker. Refugees express a markedly different motive in their immigration. Immigrants to the United States generally come, whether legally or illegally, to better their lives. They're looking for opportunities to work. And for years, you'd find them working in the meat industry, the farm industry, and so forth. But refugees, they seek shelter for life itself. The refugee communities arise from a more urgent, more exceptional circumstances than do the mere immigration. And therefore, they should be dealt with differently. When we look at the issue right now, most of the people coming up are coming from what we call the Northern Triangle, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And the number of people coming from this region has surpassed the number of Mexicans by more than 100,000 people now. So it's people who they're trying to leave the violence. They're trying to escape the gang wars, the drug wars. It's vastly different from anything that we've seen in our nation's history. So for years, most of the people coming up would have been, Mexican migrants seeking to, make money and remit it back to their countries of origin. But now there's people who are actually leaving their countries of origin, seeking life itself.
Dr. Tarwater, I hope you will come back and join us again to continue this conversation. And you are at Cedarville University, I think we have to be quick to say to our listeners, it's not a bastion of liberalism. You are coming from not only a Christian worldview, but a conservative Christian worldview. And I think that as evangelicals sort of reclaim what that word means, and the compassionate side of the word, that it's enacting the gospel. It's not just declaring it with our words, but declaring it in a holistic way to the whole person. You are helping us have this conversation in a way that I think really honors Jesus. So thank you so much.
Carmen, thank you so much again for the invitation. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. So that's Dr. John Tarwater. He is at Cedarville University. You can check out what they are doing at cedarville.edu.
All right, so one of our listeners is concerned that we don't really hear solutions very often, that we hear philosophy, and that, you know, we've got streets of homeless people in our cities, and obviously we have a real crisis at the southern border. Let me just say this. The solution is actually very clear. There is a solution, and the solution is a gospel, big G, gospel revolution. That's the solution. That is the solution to every sickness and ill that you see in the culture and in society today. If you do not like the harvest of our particular culture, then you and I, as ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven, have to start tilling the soil of the culture around us. We are the ones who have to plant the seed, not only of faith, but plant the seed of the word of God. And we are the ones who have to, through the living water that's gushing up within us to eternal life, have to pour that water out on the parched earth and the barren places of the culture in which we now live. We were set by God in a garden. We are supposed to be gardeners. That's our job. And so if you don't like the harvest of unrighteousness being produced in the current culture in which you live, you're responsible to get out there and till the soil and move the rocks and change it. So what the solution is, a gospel revolution, and it's a revolution that starts in the hearts and minds of Christians. It is about the restoration of the Word of God to its rightful place in the life of every believer and in the life of the church. It is about the restoration of the church to her rightful calling in the world. And that's going to mean that there's a lot of people who need to be converted to the big G gospel as a kingdom calling, and not just a sort of me and Jesus get my ticket punched for heaven small G gospel. It's a gospel revolution, and that's what's needed. And you and I need to be on the forefront of it as Christians who get it. Christians who get it. If you get it, let it get you today and get out there. All right, friends, you are listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.